Right, ladies and gentlemen, it's very good indeed to see you here. Particularly, I would like to introduce you to our wonderful guest today, Chris Hobley, who I've had the pleasure of knowing intimately for the last 3 years. Chris has probably had one of the most difficult jobs in government, which is in working in Dexia, the Department for Exiting the European Union, and the newly created department, rapidly created post the Brexit vote. And I don't know when you first started, whether you actually had an office or whether you were one of the people in Starbucks, because it was so rapidly created that there was very little office space for them to actually do their job. Now, obviously, Dexia's played a really important role, and of course, one of the questions that I'd like to ask, but he can't answer, is what's going to happen to Dexia post exit. And that brings me to a key point, that Chris is in quite a difficult position at the moment because of PERDA. And PERDA, he would explain better than I, but basically it does constrain anyone with connected with the government about what they can and cannot say in the period running up to the election. So it's particularly important that what is said today isn't tweeted out. It is being recorded, but it won't go out until after the election. So this is not just Chatham House rules. It's please, we've got the benefit of Chris here and his knowledge, but please do not publicise what he has been saying, because it will put him in an extremely difficult position. So I hope we can operate on that basis of trust. Chris, thank you very much indeed. He's going to talk for 20 minutes or so, and then he's going to take questions, and he will answer the ones he feels able to do so. Thank you.
No worries. Thank you.
Shall I stand? Can
I don't know if I need a microphone.
If you stand there, because of the microphone.
Because the microphone. Okay, fine. I have a notoriously soft voice, so I will stand here. And if you can't hear me, just wave. Okay, please. So, Catherine, thank you. Thank you for the introduction. So just by way of background on me before I start talking. So my name's Chris Hobley. I've been a civil servant now for 18 years. I spent much of my civil service career doing kind of regulatory policy around the various economic frameworks that govern how the UK works, so around companies, so company law, social and employment, consumer law, that kind of stuff. And for much of that, I've been doing EU law as well. So I had a bit of academic background to that. I did a master's in European studies. So that's unusual, someone in the UK civil service who actually studied EU stuff. I spent 4 years out in UKREP, which is where Catherine, you and I first encountered each other, doing social and employment law. That was very good fun. My job was to say no. I did it a lot, and I did it effectively, so that was quite a negotiation. It's quite a set of negotiations. And I've done lots of other EU negotiations back on the... back in the Home Civil Service. I then moved to the Cabinet Office in June 23rd, 2016, because I was meant to be preparing for the UK presidency of the EU 2017. That was the plan. A few days later, the referendum happened and my job description changed, and I've been doing Brexit, ever since. And as you say, Catherine, in the beginning, it was very much like a startup. You know, we started off with 40 people in the attic on the fourth floor in 70 Whitehall, which is the Cabinet Office linked in with number 10. And we very quickly grew. In fact, we grew two whole departments. One was for exiting the EU. One was for these new trade deals that at some point we will be doing. And as the people came in, you know, we started to, as you say, colonize Starbucks and colonize other rooms, and had kind of bouncy chairs as we grew into a normal new Department of State. So so it's been quite a journey. It's been quite a journey doing Brexit from the beginning. And what I do now, I'm one of the two directors for Market Access. In practice, that means that I've been involved in the withdrawal agreement negotiations, some of the technical aspects of the withdrawal agreement negotiations over the last few years. I've been involved in the preparations for the future negotiations as well, and I was involved in the recent renegotiations bit over the last few months. So what am I going to talk about? What I was going to talk about was reflections on Brexit, the road to here and the path ahead. Then the election was called, so the title, I'm afraid, is no longer quite what I can talk about. PERDA rules say that I can talk, that I can continue doing stakeholder events, and I can talk about facts, but I should not be speculating about the future, and I need to steer clear of issues that are politically controversial. So bear with me today. So what I was going to do was I was going to do some reflections, just remind us a little bit about the journey so far, and what's just happened. I want to talk a little bit about why it's been so hard. I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that I think we might have learned, certainly from a UK perspective. I wanted to have some reflections on what we might have learned from an EU perspective as well. And then I thought I might talk a little bit about some of the kind of key themes that are going to be relevant in any scenario and are, I think, suitably non-political for given PERDA rules. And I hope that's okay with you. So let's just remind ourselves about what has happened, and I'll do this a bit quickly because I think we've all lived it, but it is useful to remind ourselves. So, referendum, June 2016, 3 days after I started a new job, that obviously set the clock ticking on our 2 years of leaving. The interesting thing then was actually about the process. What happened next was the decisions about how the process would work. Decisions, obviously, that we would divorce first, and then we would agree a new relationship. Now, it's quite interesting that, because strictly speaking, you know, that needn't have been the way in which you do it. You don't necessarily have to divorce before you then agree how you're going to reattach yourself. You can, in theory, do that all in one step. But that was not the way it was decided, for good reasons or bad, is moot. That was the way it was decided. And so we therefore spent up to 18 months basically negotiating the divorce. And that all took quite a bit longer than I think was originally predicted, which is interesting. It wasn't because of the money. That was the thing that everyone thought it would be all about, but it wasn't. The money was actually negotiated pretty quickly. It wasn't about people, citizens' rights. Both sides agreed that it was a priority. There were some very difficult negotiations on that. But again, they happened quickly. But actually, it was because, as we now know, it was because of Northern Ireland. So we had those 18 months. Once those were concluded, let's just remind ourselves what those were. 541 pages of divorce. 31 pages of future. Yeah, it's an interesting way of spending 18 months if you think about it. We then had the canter through the UK ratification end. We had 3 attempts at a meaningful vote. Those did not succeed, and so 2 extensions later, we then had a new Prime Minister. So we then enter this summer. We start again. We have a revised withdrawal agreement, a revised political declaration. They're revised, in particular, through providing greater clarity about what we think the UK's economic relationship will look like with the EU, arguably a more distant one, and also revised with respect to exactly how the modalities with respect to Northern Ireland will work. That deal did, of course, pass its second reading in Parliament, but from a government perspective, there were then concerns about how that process would work, and in particular, how amendments for the ratification of the proposal, what those might mean, and also Parliament itself had concerns. Parliament's own concerns expressed in particular in the beginning in relation to the length of time it was allowed for scrutiny, and you know, quite possibly future amendments to be tabled and so on, led to the position where the government and the opposition agreed that it was time for another election and another extension. So, that's been the process. Why has it been so hard? I mean, why have we spent so long on this, doing this before? And one of the first reasons that people often say is that, you know, it's so hard because it's never been done before. There's been no blueprint. We need to work it all out. We need to kind of unravel it. And I think that is true only up to a point, because it's true that it's never been done before. But actually, if we look at just how quickly the negotiations on the withdrawal agreement went, comparatively speaking, actually, you know, the divorce bit, on the whole, was done pretty quickly. And forming relationships with third countries is something that the EU is very used to doing. So I think really the interesting thing is the blockage in that, which the negotiations really brought out. And really, Northern Ireland crystallised that by going through a process of divorcing first and then coming back together. You had exposed very quickly a very unusual set of circumstances, where of priorities that were very, very different, difficult to reconcile. You've got on the one hand, the absolute requirement of the EU and of the UK to not have a hard border on the island of Ireland, combined with the UK insistence that it would not be seeking single market membership, and consequently could not wish away the hard border through single market membership, plus EU requirements on the unity of the single market and upholding the principles of the single market itself. And when you think of that as being something that has been, that is a logic that is being applied not to an entire country, but to a bit of a country, that is when you get priorities that are in fundamental conflict with each other and have taken quite a long time to resolve. Second reason is I think also the obvious one that we have seen played out on the domestic side, which is, you know, we have a government at the moment still that has no majority that was unable to find a working majority in Parliament for the deal that it was able to put forward. And with these two factors, you know, both the difficulty of reconciling different objectives and where you stand on the UK domestic side, you get to something that was much more challenging, I think, than maybe what was foreseen. So what does that tell us about the UK, and what have we learned through this process? I mean, a few different reflections. I think the first is, it's definitely not for me to say how well or not well the government has negotiated over the last few years. What I would say is that, administratively speaking, what the government has done has been incredibly impressive. I mean, setting up two entirely new departments in flight whilst doing something that hasn't been done before, recruiting literally thousands of new civil servants into government, and having them think about not just the negotiation side, you know, what do you need to do to divorce and then come back together again, but also the delivery side, and in particular preparing for the insurance policy that is no deal, is really quite something. You know, it has required a wrenching round, a reorientation of the state, a reprioritization of ministers and senior officials' time, and you know, it's quite unlike anything that any civil servant that I know has ever seen before. So, seeing the British state do that has been really quite something and quite impressive. You know? The thing that's gone hand in glove with that, I think, has been the question about whether the other functions of the state have, how they have adapted to that. I'm not a constitutional expert, and so I'm not going to speculate much on this, apart from just observing the amount of comment that there has been about whether the checks and balances between executive and judiciary and parliament, whether those have operated and coped effectively with Brexit. There's a reasonable argument that actually they've stood up pretty well to the strain, and just have adapted and evolved in order to deal with these difficult circumstances. But as I say, you know, there's been a growing debate about whether the checks and balances are right and appropriate, and you will be much better placed than me to comment on that. I think another thing that I have definitely witnessed has been a growing understanding and awareness that not just in government, but also across the population as a whole over these last 2 years. I mean, I was responsible for the sector reports, which some of you who have slightly longer memories will recall, the hidden economic sector reports that the government had done, sector reports across the entire economy, which weren't very hidden and weren't very secret at all, and which we did our best to publish something that was vaguely sensible after Parliament required it of us in December last year. And what was really striking about when we first got involved in all that was in June, July 2016, we first went out to Whitehall to ask them, how does your sector of the economy relate to the European institutional framework? You know, describe your area of the economy, describe the regulatory framework, think how it will be affected under different scenarios. And they went and they wrote some reports, and having to reread all of them before we published them for Parliament. You know, some of them were excellent, you know, people who really understood their stuff already in July, August 2016, and some were really not very good at all. And the most common question that we got back at that time during this process was a lot of people saying to us, what is this customs union? What is the EU customs union, and what impact does it have? And if you think about that now, I mean, it's extraordinary. You know, I mean, it's not just the administration as a whole that has completely internalized all that and has completely internalized and learned all about what it means to be a third country, what's the difference between single market membership, what's the difference between the kind of terms that you can negotiate in an FTA. It's the public as a whole. You know, we have extremely intelligent, sophisticated debates on TV with the general population as a whole, where people have genuinely learned stuff about how this very complex regulatory framework and our relationship with the EU actually operates in a way that we just didn't have before. So, you know, that's been pretty impressive. I think the final things that I just wanted to reflect on was, on the one hand, was population thinking versus intensity. So on the one hand, we have a population with a referendum result that isn't massively out of kilter with survey results that certainly Ipsos has been doing over the last 20 or so years. You know, the population as a whole has always been quite ambivalent about the EU project, and in 2016 it came out the way that it did. But what's been clear is that the intensity of feeling has definitely increased dramatically. You know, the intensity, whereas in 2005, just before the election, opinion polls were saying that Europe did not make it into voters' top five areas of most concern. Actually, that nowadays is most definitely no longer the case. So people care in a way that they simply didn't do before as a population at large. Some thoughts about then the EU side of things. I mean, firstly, I described before how dealing with Brexit has caused the state to be reoriented with resources, with additional resources brought in, spent, prioritised in order to deal with the challenges of Brexit. As you can imagine, from a member state perspective, that's been a real challenge as well. You know, if you are a member state, you've got your own priorities to be worrying about, and for some of them, Brexit will be very high on their list, and for some of them, it won't be. And so some member states have therefore been intimately involved with the Brexit process, our Irish partners very evidently so, you know, the Germans, the French, and so on. And with others, it's a it's a difficult, nebulous thing for them to be getting their heads around and is lower down their priority list, given the other things that they themselves care about. And so what that has meant is that there has been a very strong reliance, therefore, on the role of the European Commission in this process versus that of the member states as well. You know, inevitably, given how difficult it is, given the swathe of subject areas to be covered, that's perhaps not very surprising, but it has definitely shown itself in negotiations. I think what have we learned about the EU as negotiators? I mean, everything that we always knew before. I mean, the EU are tactically excellent, yeah. Even in the areas that could be weaknesses, you know, the fact that you've got such a diverse bunch of countries with different priorities, actually the EU has turned into real strengths, you know, have turned into ensuring that the principle of unity is actually in itself a major negotiating objective for the member states. And as a result of that, they have been able to gather member states around a position really very, very quickly. Ditto, the need for transparency from an EU perspective has been turned into a strength. Everything is published very quickly, very openly. The interesting question is whether, and of course from a technical level, by the way, my EU counterparts are excellent. Very, very able. Negotiators, very competent. Very nice until they're in the room. Then, you know, they're very able negotiators. So, there is that. From a strategic perspective, I think it's too early to tell whether the EU's positions, though, have always been wise. You know, in theory, we will all want, ultimately, a close UK-EU relationship. But the overarching strategic desire to protect the EU, including in particular to preserve the single market, means that there are at least some parts of the EU that are worried about doing anything that feels or looks too bespoke or too close. And so hence, we've had the famous staircase slide put forward by Monsieur Barnier that has... that has set out the view that actually there's only standard models that you can have, and if by definition UK you are ruling out certain things here and here and here, then this is the only thing that is left, and this is the logical conclusion of where you go to. And this, of course, explains then the EU's dismissal of the UK's white paper, the Chequers' white paper, notwithstanding the fact that it was a genuinely serious document and a genuinely serious attempt at meeting all of the red lines. From both sides, and notwithstanding the fact that some of the bits that were rejected by the EU at the time somehow seem to have found their way back into the Northern Ireland Protocol. And notwithstanding the fact that, of course, experience has shown that the EU is very capable of doing things bespoke when it's in its own interest to do so. You know, I mean, every single one of its major different models was, you know, whether it's with the EEA, whether it's with Switzerland, whether it's with the Ukraine, all of these were different models that hadn't been done before, but which it was felt the interests of the EU would be best served by doing something a bit different from what had been done before. And indeed, we see that bits of the current negotiation as well, there's a little bit of bespokery from the EU side that does creep in as well. You know, whether it's Northern Ireland, you know, the kind of triumvirate of priorities that I've described before, again, is not something that the EU has encountered before in its negotiations with a third country. Certainly, you know, some of the demands that it has when it comes to fish, to the level playing field, such as on social employment, again, these are not the kinds of things that have been asked before of a country with whom the EU would have a standard third country future trading relationship. So I think the interesting strategic question is whether the EU will settle on a proposal that actually from a British perspective also will appear reasonable in terms of rights and obligations. And I think that really matters, because if you want to have a stable relationship, a sustainable and stable one, then it needs to feel fair. It needs to feel legitimate in the long term. And so arguably, there's something there about a little bit of generosity needed on both sides to get oneself there. Finally, and then I will stop, some reflections of some of the key themes of things that we are definitely going to be talking about more in the future. One is around this constitutional question, you know, the role of Parliament versus the role of the executive and constitutional change. I mean, this hasn't gone away at all. We are going to have very interesting discussions about the UK mandate setting process, about the ratification of a future deal, and that's just with respect to the EU. We're going to be doing exactly the same when it comes to third country deals as well. So quite how all that works its way through, what exactly the role of Parliament will be, all to be decided in the coming months. The Union, I haven't talked about it very much so far, but you know, the Brexit has undoubtedly put real strains on the existing relationship, and we will simply need to see how that plays out going forward. Northern Ireland is obviously something that will require particular care. The case of Scotland is currently a political argument in the election as well. The other thing, Wales, clearly also very relevant and very interesting to see how the Welsh government is adopting positions that are increasingly not the same as those of the current UK government. So interesting to see how that trend, whether and how that trend continues going forward. I think the other thing, often not thought about much, is the Crown dependencies and the overseas territories. These very interesting entities with whom we have historic long-term relationships and bespoke relationships with the EU, quite how that pans out, again, is something that requires a lot of continued careful thought. Finally, I just wanted to make the, I think, quite trite observation that I think Brexit's here to stay, whatever happens. I mean, the debate about the relationship with Europe is not an economic debate. It's about a whole bunch of values, of which economic values is just one of them. And given the extent to which the population and the political classes are seized of that, and the way it is played into the politics of the various governments of the United Kingdom and the nations of the United Kingdom, we're going to be discussing Brexit and our relationship with Europe for, you know, a long time to come. So I'll stop with that.
Thank you.